And thanks for listening to our Conversations with the Candidates series. My guest today is John Morse. He is a candidate in the 3rd District here in Maryland for the House of Representatives in a very crowded Democratic primary. There are 22 candidates in all in the Democratic primary seeking to get the nomination for the election to succeed John Sarbanes, who is retiring at the end of this term. That's the beginning of January 2025. John Morse is 38 years old. He lives in Annapolis. He was born originally in Elgin, Illinois. He has a bachelor's degree from Villanova University and a law degree from Gonzaga University School of Law out in Spokane, Washington. He has most recently worked as the Associate General Counsel for the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA-AFL-CIO. This is his first try for elective office. He is married with one child, and as I mentioned, he lives in Annapolis. He's received some pretty high-profile endorsements, including those from Senator Bernie Sanders, Sean Fain, the president of the United Auto Workers, and Sarah Nelson, the president of the Flight Attendants Union. And he joins me here at WYPR. It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
So why a run for Congress? It's a very crowded field. Why jump in?
I jumped in. Well, Tom, for the last 12 years, I've been a labor lawyer for flight attendants. And so the issues impacting working people are first and foremost to me. And I waited a couple of months before I jumped in, and I watched the candidates who came in, and I didn't see people talking about the issues that are most important to me and to the people in this district, and that's having a fair economy that works for everybody. And so by the time somebody, when someone is born to when they're retiring, you see an economy that we have all the resources where we can take care of people, and that's exactly what we need to be pushing with running for Congress.
And why Congress in particular? What about that particular branch of the legislative system, you know, as opposed to a state office, even a local office or federal office?
Yeah, well, you know, and a lot of people ask me, why didn't you start running on the local level or a delegate or state senator? And for me, I'm not a career politician, and I'm not in politics to have it as a stepping stone to something bigger. I've always gone where I see the greatest need to help people. That's what I've done throughout my entire career when I have fought on behalf of flight attendants. And so when I saw the seat open up unexpectedly, I don't think any of us expected John Sarbanes to retire.
Yeah, it was a surprise,
yeah. Yeah, and so when I jumped in this race, I saw that's where I could do the greatest need. I have the most experience of everybody in this field with getting things done in D.C. As part of my work with the labor union, with the Association of Flight Attendants, I've worked on legislation under both Republican and Democratic administrations, and we've had laws passed that have helped keep people connected to their jobs during the pandemic. And we made sure that people were safe in their workplace. And I'm really proud of the work that I've done and the relationships I've established on the Hill.
And talk about those relationships. I mean, in what have you been on the Hill in any other capacity other than a labor lawyer for the Flight Attendants Association?
No, throughout my career, I have worked on legislation for more than a decade. And I'm a progressive. And so I've worked with Republican offices, Democratic offices. But as a progressive, I'm really keyed into the progressive movement. And so members of the Labor Caucus and the Progressive Caucus in particular are people that I work with all the time. And I see my candidacy as one more brick in this progressive wall to really enact real meaningful change for everyday Americans.
Is the labor movement in the United States, in your estimation, on an upswing? There are a lot of folks who think that there's been a kind of a renaissance, a rebirth of the labor movement in general. There were some big wins for labor in 2023. The UAW, Sean Fain, who's one of the people who's endorsed you, was seen to have been very successful in those negotiations. The writers and the actors strikes that took place in Hollywood and New York, also seen as victories for those union members. What's your take?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think unquestionably, labor is on a huge upswing. 75% of Americans support labor unions. And that's because people see the justice that labor unions bring to working people. I mean, as part of the labor movement, we're out there fighting for people every day, and we want everybody to have the best quality of life possible. I've negotiated several contracts at airlines, multi-million-dollar contracts, and have improved the lives of lots of flight attendants and lots of airline workers. And so I'm really proud of the labor movement and what we have accomplished already. And you see this upswing where after decades of decline, we have people like President Sean Fain and President Sarah Nelson, who are real champions for people and have been such an inspiration to me.
And we should make clear that you've left your position with the Flight Attendants Association to run for Congress full time.
That's right.
And you mentioned that you're a progressive. You know, the political bifurcation in the United States has been becoming more acute and more ossified by the day, it seems. What about the role of bipartisanship? A lot of folks talk about the need to reach across the aisle. You just talked about working with both Republicans and Democrats to craft legislation, et cetera. Where does the aspiration of bipartisan cooperation and compromise fit into your political philosophy?
Yeah, well, I mean, at the end of the day, we have one job, and that's to make lives better for everybody. And that's the number one thing that I would be thinking about when I wake up in the morning and what would guide me throughout my day. I absolutely want to work with anybody who will work to improve the lives of working people and make the lives of families better. And so whether it's quality childcare that's affordable, reducing student loan debt, or making sure that we're not only protecting Social Security but expanding those benefits, those are all things that I want to work with anybody on. I think the problem is you hear bipartisanship and working across the aisle, and it's become this phrase that doesn't really work in this Congress. And people like Matt Gaetz, they don't want to work with us. And so I see in all my years of negotiating, we need to, you have this philosophy that something's better than nothing from a lot of moderates out there. And I just disagree with that. I think that when you get something that is not as good and doesn't actually address the underlying issues, people in D.C. just wash their hands of it. And then we don't actually solve the problem. And so I want to work with anybody on issues that improve working people's lives. But if at the end of the day, the solutions that they're putting forth don't actually do that, then we need to be this progressive wall to actually outwork them and outorganize them.
And doesn't that ultimately then, can't it often lead to complete stalemate? I mean, this past Congress has been the least productive Congress since the Second World War. They considered more than 700 bills. They passed fewer than 30. In terms of actual legislation and any moving of the needle on a whole variety of issues, it just doesn't happen. People have, you know, staked out their claims on the left and on the right, and no one seems to meet in the middle.
Yeah, and I think that's unfortunate. And I think you see that very much so with the modern Republican Party. I mean, the Trump Republican Party is not our grandfather's Republican Party. I mean, this is a party where, I mean, can you ever imagine that we wouldn't come to the defense of Ukraine under the previous Republican Party? And so they really have become this ultra-right nationalist party that doesn't really care about people and that just cares about enriching corporations and making it so that that their donors benefit from their positions in Congress. And that's the problem here.
So is the solution just beat them, just, you know, get voters to come to the ballot box and kick them out of Congress, which, given the gerrymandering that we have around the country, is probably, you know, an impossible dream, at least in the short term? Or is it to work with them? Let's take a specific example, and that of immigration. Mm-hmm. So there's HB1 in the mm-hmm. House, where Speaker Mike Johnson has proposed a bill that's, you know, got some very strict and harsh parameters for immigration. And then there's the Senate bill that was negotiated by Senator Lankford from Oklahoma, a very conservative senator, worked on it for 4 months, allegedly, came up with a compromise that the Senate passed. Sent it to the House, and the House decided not to take it up because Mr. Trump decided he would rather just complain about it on the campaign trail. Had you been in the House now, would you have supported the Lankford compromise? I mean, it's a compromise that has, you know, certain dimensions that a lot of progressives don't like.
Right, and me included, Tom. I mean, there, of course, were some good provisions in there. And, you know, unfortunately, they tied aid to Ukraine, I know, with a lot of this, too.
Right. That's a whole other issue.
Yeah, whole other issue. And I just want to be really clear. I wholeheartedly support Ukraine and aid to that. And it's terrible that they insert these poison pills into this legislation where the people of Ukraine need our help and they need it right now. And so with the immigration bill, you know, Tom, let me tell you that in 2016, I saw when Trump got elected, I, like a lot of people, was very upset. And I wanted to do something about it. And so I started representing undocumented children during that time. And I've represented several of them over the years in asylees. And these are some of the best people in this country. And they deserve our love and respect and support. And so when I see these quote-unquote, you know, bipartisan bills, it's exactly the kind of problem that I'm talking about, where it doesn't actually address the underlying issue. I think that it would have a lot of problems where it would really lead to people going to desperate means to enter this country, even more so. And we need kindness.
And in that regard, you're talking about the stricter conditions for asylum claims?
Exactly, yes. Yeah, and Title 42, like expulsions here, too. And so we need kindness to everybody, and no one more so than people who are coming to our shores who are seeking a better life. I really believe that. When I entered this race, I wanted to have the kind of campaign that I'd be really proud of and where I really stood on my values, and that those are my values. I think that we fight for everybody, and especially the most vulnerable among us, and that is migrants coming to this country. And so when you see this legislation, it seems great. We're talking about bipartisanship, but it doesn't actually address the underlying issue in a way that is humane and fair. And that's the issue I have with it, because they're people.
And of course, immigration has been tied to Ukraine. It's also been tied to aid for Israel. We're speaking on the 18th of April today. Speaker Mike Johnson is proposing separate votes for aid to Israel, Gaza, aid to Taiwan, aid to Ukraine, and stricter national security measures, a fourth separate bill. And for that, it's now threatened that he would be, face a vacate vote. Marjorie Taylor Greene and Congressman Massey from Kentucky have signed on to that proposal. So let's talk about Israel-Gaza. And what the United States should be doing. There are divisions within the Democratic Party about that, divisions concerning President Biden himself. The fact that they're all mushed up together is a separate issue. We'll talk about that in a minute. But when it comes to support for Israel, should we be withholding it because of their prosecution of the war?
Yeah, well, Tom, I think Jose Andres said it best when he said, you can't bomb your way out of this. You can't starve people to get the hostages back. It's not going to work. And right now, when I see 33,000 people, mainly women and children, who have died, that is completely unacceptable to me. I am the most outspoken candidate in this race about Gaza. And, you know, let's be clear. What happened on October 7th was horrible. None of us, you know, we all condemn that. But Israel's response is not proportionate. And it is very, very troubling. And to see so many people suffering is something that, as a member of Congress, you have to speak up against. And it's our obligation to talk about justice here. And right now, it is horrible that there are these hostages that are still out there in Gaza. And Hamas is a horrible terrorist organization. You see Iran and what they're doing now. And let's be clear, they've been behind the scenes, you know, for a lot of this too. But that doesn't mean that we have so many innocent lives lost, people who had nowhere to go. They couldn't escape the bombing. And that's very different than a lot of other conflicts that we've seen around the world. I saw an NPR article about this, I think a couple of months ago, a study talking about, if we extrapolate from the losses that we've seen so far, we're talking about maybe upwards of 100,000 people dead. That we have got to speak up and stop that right now.
But as you mentioned, Israel's in a very dangerous neighborhood.
Yes.
The last couple of weeks from the time that we're speaking, they've had to fend off, 300 plus ballistic crews missiles and drones. They did that with a multinational force. The Jordanians participated in that. The Americans helped intercept some of those missiles before they even reached Israeli airspace? Should we make, military support for Israel conditional on their agreeing to a unilateral ceasefire?
Yeah, I think it's really important that we do that, Tom. I mean, right now, U.S. Tax dollars are being used to fund these bombs in Gaza. And I think it's really important that we do step in here and say that Israel has the absolute right to defend themselves, and what happened to their people is awful and completely unacceptable. But this is different. What's happening, these are really two different issues, what's happening in Gaza versus what happened on October 7th. And when you see so much heartache and loss, I met a voter in my district who's lost 29 people to this conflict in Gaza. And you see that and you feel his heartbreak. These are people who lost their lives, who had hopes and dreams just like the rest of us. And I think you can't help but feel their pain when you read about it and you see what's going on there.
And the possibility of a wider conflict, possibility of Iran continuing involvement, the possibility of Israel deciding to respond to the Iranian attacks, the possibilities of Hezbollah in the north and Lebanon getting involved, does that give you pause if we are to stop funding or stop supplying the Israeli military? Doesn't that leave them? And you mentioned, October 7th was terrible, and what's happening in Gaza is terrible. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. Iranian bombs being hurled at Israel is also terrible, and the possibility of escalating the war seems to be a very real one. Certainly, it's of concern to the Biden administration and to a lot of observers. How does that figure into a calculation of what to do?
Yeah, well, Tom, I want to be clear. I do support providing weapons to Israel for defensive measures. And so I want to make sure that your listeners understand that, because I think that's really important, because you're right, it is a very dangerous neighborhood for Israel. I see this conflict as requiring diplomacy, and diplomacy first here. And so that's why we need this permanent humanitarian ceasefire immediately. And when I see the rising escalation going on here with, you're right, all of these parties going on, we need to stop that right now. And I think President Biden has done a good job in insisting on diplomacy and trying to de-escalate the situation here. I go back to things like the Iran nuclear deal, where we had diplomacy, we were able to de-escalate tension. And then, of course, Trump came along and Netanyahu, and you see... you see this continuing escalation over years where they're not putting diplomacy first, and that's really important here.
When it comes to Ukraine and other foreign policy or any policy issue, what does success look like to you? I mean, given the fact that, Ukraine is now clearly hurting on the battlefield because of a lack of ammunition. We hear these terrible stories about rationing bullets for the people who are out fighting in the field and on the front lines. Given the fact that Speaker Johnson has, withheld this aid now, refused to take a vote on it for months, I mean, just weeks and weeks and weeks, the situation gets ever more dire as the days go by. What does success look like given the bifurcation in Congress? If you were a member now, what would you think was doable and achievable? Given the current climate?
Well, I think it is absolutely doable and achievable to supply Ukraine with weapons here and to make sure that they can defend themselves. And part of the problem that we see here is the Republican Party is so dysfunctional. You're right. Mike Johnson does one wrong thing, and all of a sudden the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world are going to try to oust him, like we're hearing already. I think it's about trying to reach out and build relationships with Republicans in a way where we can talk about things like Ukraine. I mean, this is common sense, Tom. I mean, these are very basic positions that I think the vast majority of Americans support. Certainly people in my district overwhelmingly support Ukraine. To think about supporting Putin over Ukraine, like Trump seems to be intimating, at least, if not outwardly embracing, is un-American. And so I think we continue to appeal to the American values here. I'm really proud to be an American because we have always stood up throughout history as this beacon of hope and freedom around the world. And that's exactly what we have to do here, too.
Let's talk about some of the other issues that are on the minds of folks in the 3rd District, sort of, you know, district-specific mm-hmm. issues, if you will. What are you hearing from voters, and what do you think? What priorities would you bring to Washington if you're successful in this election?
Yeah, well, Tom, you know, I'm an airline lawyer, and so I represented airline workers for over 12 years, and we have BWI in the district. I think that's really important here. I know airline workers really well, and I know their issues. I have fought on behalf of them for a long time, and whether we're in litigation or negotiating contracts, I know what their lives are like, and I've worked with them day in and day out. Having so many airline workers and having BWI in our district, it's really important to have someone who understands the airline industry and transportation in general. And so I look at transportation as a major issue that we need to make sure to address on the local level and on the national level. When I got in this race, I thought the number one issue that I would hear from voters would be abortion and the environment. And I certainly hear a lot about that. But the number one thing I hear about is just wanting a member of Congress who tells the truth. And how sad is that for our state of democracy that that's what they want? So I've always tried to be really clear with people about what my positions are. And we have very detailed positions that we lay out. And that's really important here because the voters need to know what you stand for. And I'm always going to be very transparent. And I mean, those who know me know I wear my heart on my sleeve. And there's no hiding the ball with me. And you're going to know how I stand on an issue. And I think the voters really appreciate that.
Would there be much of a departure between your political philosophy and that of John Sarbanes, who's been a very popular representative for, you know, however many years now?
Right. Yeah. John Sarbanes is amazing. The work that he has done on our election work is incredible. And he, especially coming from one of the most gerrymandered districts historically in the country, I think it's especially admirable the work that he's done in championing this and keeping money out of politics. And that's something that I wholeheartedly want to embrace. I mean, we have a super PAC that has entered this race now. And Democrats don't like money in politics when it comes from these dark money groups. It's something that is completely unacceptable. And after Citizens United, you see the need to address this and how it has really hurt our democracy. That's one of my top priorities. And I think Congressman Sarbanes has been such a champion on that issue. And I absolutely will continue to fight for that.
The 3rd District is a geographically pretty large district, all of Howard County, a little bit of Anne Arundel, a little bit of Carroll. Do you see any discrepancy, any tension even between the needs of the folks in, you know, Western Howard County and the needs of folks in Annapolis? I mean, there are, you know, they're in the same district, but locally, you know, they may have different priorities, different needs. Is that something you're picking up on as you're campaigning?
I think, Tom, people, like everybody, cares about the same issues. They want a good quality of life for their families. And so they talk to me about the cost of childcare. The fact that there's no paid family leave, that's something that's really important to me. I work to secure family leave for flight attendants because they were frequently not qualifying for family leave over the years. And so we fixed that. We defended that in federal court then, and I worked with the Department of Labor to make sure that that happened. Things like the cost of education. I mean, when I'm still paying back my student loans, and my interest rate was 11-something percent when I got them. And that is insane. And I think not only do we need to reduce the cost of student loans and the interest rates, but we need to make college more affordable in general because we should be rewarding people who want to educate themselves. And whether it's registered apprenticeships or college or community college, these are all things that as a society we benefit from when people go and enrich themselves. So that's all really important here. These are the kind of issues that I hear from people, and I think people are just really afraid with the cost of living. I talk to seniors all the time who talk about they have a fixed income, and that means less money out of their pocket when they're going to pay for the same goods with the cost of living increases. That doesn't work. We need to be champion our seniors, and we promised them that we would take care of them, and I'm fully in support of that.
Let's talk about health care. Of course, reproductive health care is going to be a big issue nationally at the federal level, and it's an issue that pretty much every Democrat that I've talked to in this race for the 3rd District says that the parameters of Roe v. Wade should be codified into federal law. That's something that President Biden supports. Is that something you support as well?
100%, yeah. And the right to abortion is so important. And unfortunately, it's not the only thing that's being threatened right now, the right to access contraception. The right to interstate travel, that's a fundamental right in our Constitution, and Republicans are fighting to restrict that.
I think you're talking about restricting travel if you're in a state that prohibits abortion from that state to another state so
exactly.
You could receive reproductive health care.
Yes, exactly. And I think what a lot of people don't understand is that all of these are tied together. It's the right to privacy. That is a really important provision here. The foundation for Roe, the foundation for marriage equality, the foundation to access contraception is all this right to privacy. And so that's why you see conservative justices like Justice Thomas signaling that he's ready to overturn all those decisions. So all of these issues are on the ballot right now, and there's going to be no greater champion for those issues than me.
We've talked about your involvement in the labor movement, representing the flight attendants. Let's talk about economic development in the 3rd District and how the federal government has a capacity to affect change and to affect economic development. What are the key dimensions of the federal involvement in the economies of the 3rd District?
Yeah, well, I mean, the federal, intervention in our local economy is so important here. I mean, look at what's going on with the Key Bridge. It's really important that that we rebuild the Key Bridge as quickly as possible. I mean, the state of Maryland is losing so much money on revenue from that, and not to mention traffic that's going on now because of this. And so, you talked about some of the different components with the district, and I think about Howard County in particular when it comes to traffic, where people, I think their average commute time is 30 minutes. And so when you look at that and you see people who aren't able to be at home as much as they want to, they're spending time stuck in traffic. There's a really terrible intersection near me in Annapolis when we're going up north to go to Baltimore. And we should be fixing that. And that's where the federal government should be coming in to work with local authorities to fix these issues and make the quality of life better for people. So transportation in particular, I think, is really important here.
And when it comes to things like regulation, federal regulation for Wall Street and for corporate behavior, people who support Mr. Trump applaud him not only for the conservative judges that he has appointed, but for his so-called insistence on, deregulating financial markets. And a good bit of deregulation, in fact, did happen in the 4 years that Mr. Trump was in office. Either became deregulated or just lax regulation. What should Congress be doing about that?
Yeah, Congress needs to be doing a lot about that because we need to know that, I mean, we're in the fight of our lives here. I mean, whether it's talking about regulations protecting the environment and our ability to live in this world or seeing the gross excess of Wall Street, regulations are really important here. I talk, to labor unions all the time and working people about regulations where that's the reason why we have safe workplaces, for example, and making sure that that we can all live in a clean, healthy planet where we have regulations that protect that is extremely important. One of the reasons why I jumped in this race was because we saw, even before the pandemic, but especially during the pandemic, this rampant expansion of wealth that continues to go to the top 1%. And meanwhile, everybody else is falling further and further behind. That's really problematic here. So I propose things like a tax on Wall Street transactions, a very modest tax on that. That's how the rich keep getting richer. That's where their wealth is tied, whereas for other people, it's tied to their homes. That's really important here that we rein that in because it's not good for our democracy to have such gross, unequal wealth distribution. That's a huge problem that we have to address.
Okay, there's corporate America and there's the regulations that apply there. How about small business? What should Congress be focusing on to help and cultivate and nourish small businesses?
Yeah, well, small businesses are the backbone of our economy. And I've talked to small business owners throughout the district. That gentleman who I mentioned before who lost 29 family members in Gaza, he's a small business owner, and he imports things through the port of Baltimore. And so right now, he can't operate. And so we need to make sure that he can stay afloat in the meantime and make sure that his workers are being provided for. We need to make sure that small businesses are always supported. There's a brewery in Annapolis that I have met with before, and I think that their owners are amazing. They have had issues too. And so making sure that local government in working with the federal government is always supporting and enhancing the ability for small businesses to succeed is really important, and it is a partnership. And so that's really important.
When it comes to the environment, climate change, should the impetus there be on the federal level, on the national level, or should it be state by state? Should it even be locality by locality? Whatever it might end up being, or any combination of them, most people think it's moving too slowly, that achieving the goals for, you know, zero emissions, et cetera, or just, you know, the progress towards that is too slow.
It is too slow, absolutely. It does take the federal government, though, to set these minimum standards. And whether it's the environment or education, the federal government has a very significant role to make sure that everybody, that every state, because we have states here that don't believe in climate change, where their local elected officials and state-level officials just don't. We need the federal government to step in here and make sure that we are meeting our climate goals, because we're running out of time here, and we need to make sure that we are meeting these goals to make sure that our kids have a future that I'm really worried about.
You mentioned John Sarbanes' great work in terms of voting rights and getting rid of dark money and the political system. When it comes to voting rights, we have the John Lewis Act, we have the Voting Rights Act, I'm not saying the exact name of that bill right, but they're stalled. They're stalled because there's a very slim Republican majority in Congress. Where do you see that effort moving in the future?
Yeah, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act is a supremely important piece of legislation, and I think Democrats overwhelmingly support it, me included. And we can absolutely pass that legislation. It is common sense. It will reinvigorate our democracy. And we need to keep electing more people to Congress who champion those issues. And so that's where I talk about having a nationwide structure where we're working together and where progressives come together to have this progressive wall to really advance this legislation and make sure that our democracy does survive the Trump being such a problem in it, and making sure that we can push these issues forward, because it's one of the most critical issues we have.
Do you support term limits for people in Congress?
Yeah, this has come up a lot recently in our race. I think that when it comes to term limits, it's really important that if we do go down that path, that we address it on a national level. Right now, you see, I know some localities have it. I know in Baltimore you have it. And I think it's really important that if we do go down that path, that it is system-wide and it's not individuals, because there is value to people who are in Congress for a long time. And we see both sides of that, I think, where maybe it's not, you know, some people maybe stick around too long. But to have uniformity with whatever the voters choose, I think is really important.
John Morris is a candidate in the Democratic primary for the nomination to succeed John Sarbanes in the 3rd Congressional District here in Maryland, one of 22 candidates in a very crowded field. I appreciate your coming in. It's good to talk to you.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it, too. I'm a longtime supporter of public radio and appreciate you.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.